The views and opinions expressed by the host and tonight's guest are not necessarily those of this radio network, its affiliates, or its sponsors. Listener discretion is advised. Now lock your doors, open your minds, and prepare yourself to go
beyond the edge.
10, 9, 8, 7, ignition sequence started. All engines are started. We have ignition, 2, 1, 0, we have a liftoff. We have a liftoff and it's lighting up the area. It's just like daylight here at Kennedy Space Center as the Saturn V is moving off the pad. It has now cleared the tower.
Lock your doors. Lock your doors. Lock your doors. Lock your doors. Open your minds. Beyond the Edge Radio is back. You're tuned into the best damn alternative talk on the planet, BTE Radio. Sunday nights and BTE Radio. Life doesn't get any better than this. Welcome back to BTE Radio. Get ready, because the sh** is about to get real. Often replicated, never duplicated, or the real deal, baby. BTE Radio. Mama warned you there'd be shows like this. Beyond the Edge Radio. Beyond the Edge Radio. Beyond the Edge Radio. If you're not listening, you're just stupid.
And good evening and welcome to another edition of Beyond the Edge Radio. It is 8:02 here on the East Coast and 5:02 on the West Coast. And tonight is Serial Killer Night. We are continuing with that theme here at BTE Radio. I'm your host and producer of the program. My name is Eric Altman. We want to welcome everybody to the show. And what show would be complete without our co-host from the West Coast, the one and only Marie Samuels. Hello, Marie. How are you doing this evening?
I am fantastic. How are you?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. It's been a very hectic and chaotic weekend, as usual for me. But we're going to wrap things up tonight of a very busy weekend with a very fun show.
Yeah, we are. Yes, indeed. This is probably the serial killer interview that I've been most looking forward to out of the four.
And me also. We have Kevin M. Sullivan joining us tonight on the program. He is an author. He writes a different variety of topics as far as what he writes. He writes true crime. He writes historical nonfiction books. He's written stuff on Custer and a lot of the things that went on during the Custer's time in the Midwest and the war against the Indians and that. Plus, he's also written, as I said, true crime books, and we're going to be talking with him specifically tonight about two of his books that he's written, and one of them being his spotlight on Ted Bundy, which is called The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, and the other, a book on a vampire killer by the name of Richard Chase, and that book is called Vampire, The Richard Chase Murders. So we'll be looking at two serial killers tonight on the program as we welcome Kevin M. Sullivan. It's going to be a fun show.
Yeah, yes, it is. I like I said, I've been waiting for this one.
Yeah, me too. I've heard Kevin on Darkness Radio a few times talking about different books that he's written. And you and I have both just watched a new program that came out on Discovery Channel. What's the name of the channel? Discovery Education?
Investigation Discovery?
That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah, the show's called Serial Thrillers, and they spotlighted, it was a three-show series, and they spotlighted Ted Bundy, and it was pretty good. You and I talked a little bit about that off-air. It wasn't bad. I think they stuck to the story pretty much the way it happened.
Yes, and, you know, being a Seattle native, I agree that they portrayed it very well. The one thing I didn't like was the actor they chose to play Ted Bundy. He looked nothing like Ted Bundy, and I know everybody probably in the world that watched the show agrees with that.
Oh, I agree with it. I thought he looked absolutely nothing like Ted Bundy. He looked like he should be on Harold and Kumar's White Castle movies or something. He did.
Well, and like I told you off air, I thought he looked more like Richard Chase than Ted Bundy.
Oh, yeah, that too. That too.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll be re-airing that three-part series probably in on-demand and in reruns. And I understand they're going to be doing more of them in the near future as well.
Well, and I think tonight they're doing like a follow-up where they're having interviews with the people that handled the case. And
yeah.
In fact, that's our competition. I think it might be on right now.
Yeah, well,
I've got my DVR set.
Me too. I'll watch it after the show.
Yep.
We'll check it out. But tonight we'll be talking about Ted Bundy and Richard Chase with Kevin Sullivan, who'll be joining us at the bottom of the hour. And we'll be talking with Sean and Marianne Donnelly. They'll be joining us in just a few minutes for the Haunted Spotlight. They have a brand new location for us this week, so we'll be joining with them in just a few minutes. But a couple of quick announcements, as promised. First and foremost, we have an updated guest list. Next week on the show, Dr. Scott Bond will be joining us, his website, docbond.com. And his book, Why We Love Serial Killers, The Curious Appeal of the World's Most Savage Killers. June 28th, Gary Stewart joins us, and he's going to be telling us what he's found out and what he believes, that his father was the Zodiac Killer. And his website, themostdangerousanimalofall.com, and the book that he's written, The Most Dangerous Animal of All, Searching for My Father and Finding the Zodiac Killer. So we'll be wrapping up Serial Killer Month in the next 2 weeks with some great guests on the program.
Absolutely. We started out with a relative, and we're ending with a relative. Potential relative.
That's true. I didn't think about it that way, but that's true.
Yeah.
July, we've got some great guests scheduled for July. We've got a program that Marie and I are going to do on July 5th after the holiday called Weird U.S., where we're going to spotlight some strange locations throughout the United States and some strange locations that people may not even have heard of or may have heard of but aren't very familiar with. So we'll be talking about those locations on July the 5th. July 12th, we welcome Jeff and Denise Checker from the Demon Hunter Society, their website, demonhuntersociety.com. July 19th, Katie Elizabeth and Dennis Hall join us for Creature Features, as we'll be talking about their research into Lake Champlain and the Champ Lake Monster. Their website is officialchampsearch.webs.com. And Karen Dolan will be also joining us. She'll be back from her week off as she moved, and she'll be back with us on the 19th of July. And then wrapping up the month, we'll have a new guest news correspondent joining us, as we'll be bringing you the paranormal news and review. So a lot of cool shows coming up in the next few weeks.
Absolutely.
Couple quick announcements as far as events go, and I'll go through these real quick, and then we'll jump into the Haunted Spotlight. Phenomenology is this weekend. Tonight is the last night to get tickets online. They stop selling them at midnight, so if you want to get your tickets for the event, go to phenomevents.com. or visit their Facebook page, which is facebook.com/phenomevents. They will be selling them at the door. They'll be selling individual day passes at the door. And I don't think they'll be selling tickets to my haunted hike that I'm going to be giving on Saturday, June 20th at Chickies Rock Park. So if you want to go with me on that haunted hike from 5 to 8:30, then you've got to get online to phenomevents.com, click on the Investigations tab, and purchase your tickets now. They're only $10. And you can come out with me to the haunted Chickies Park, hear stories of Native American tales. I'll be telling stories of ghost sightings in the park, strange creature sightings, and some of the lore and legends that have happened around the Chickies area. So check out the website, phenomevents.com. They've got a heck of a lineup of guests coming in for the event. They got guys from Ghost Hunters, Ghost Hunters International, Ghost Hunters Academy, Ghost Adventures, The Haunted Collector, Paranormal State. They've got actors from The Walking Dead going to be there. Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis from Darkness Radio will be there. A whole bunch of people will be there. So check out the website, phenomevents.com, to get your tickets and come out and see us. And then on the 27th and 28th, up in Youngsville, PA, in Island Park, is the Paranormal Fair and Craft Show. It's a free event taking place where you can come out and check out all the cool vendors there who will have crafts and displays set up. And then you can also hear paranormal lectures from some paranormal investigators, psychic mediums, and cryptozoologists on hand. So check out that event. If you go on Facebook and just type in Paranormal Fair, that's spelled F-A-I-R-E, and Craft Show, Paranormal Fair and Craft Show, you can find out information on that. Or just go to my website, ericaltman.net, and click on the Appearances tab, and there's a link right to that page. It'll give you all the information. So those are the events about what's coming up and the guests on the show. Now, for the big announcement that I've been teasing about, and this is actually pretty exciting because this is something that we were asked to be a part of, and I know I'm excited about it, Marie. I know mentioning it to you, you were pretty excited too. So
yeah.
We're going to be heading to Tampa, Florida. So if you're in the Tampa, Florida area and you're a fan of the show, now you can hear Beyond the Edge Radio on the IRN network. That's the Internet Radio Network. And they have an AM affiliate in Tampa, Florida that will be playing our show as well. We'll begin broadcasting there next week live from 8 to 10 p.m. as we always do. And the website again is internetradionetwork.com. Check it out. If you're a fan in the Tampa, Florida area, you can now hear us down there. And we're excited to be joining that network radio program. And they'll be not only playing us live, but they're putting us in the on-demand rotation so you can hear old archive shows of BTE Radio as well. So we continue to grow. We continue to get picked up by more and more networks. Things are looking up for us here.
Yep, watch out, United States. Here comes Beyond the Edge.
That's right. George who?
I don't know who you're talking about.
At any rate, we're excited about that. BTE Radio is growing, being picked up by more networks and being played more places around the country on terrestrial radio, FM, and AM radio. So we want to say thank you to those networks for coming to us and asking us to come on board. We're excited and thrilled and look forward to broadcasting next week in the Tampa, Florida area.
Absolutely.
All right. So with that said, those are all the announcements for tonight. Let's turn things over to our good friends Sean and Marianne Donnelly with the Haunted Spotlight. Good evening, Sean and Marianne. How are you folks doing this fine evening?
Hey, we're doing great. How are you guys?
We're excited. We're all thrilled tonight. You heard the big announcement about us moving to Tampa, Florida and taking over the airwaves there.
Yes, congratulations. Some great information there.
Thank you. We're pleased that we're doing that, and you guys are coming right along with us. We'll be spreading the word down there in the Tampa, Florida area soon.
Hey, we'll be along with you.
That's right.
Not a problem.
That's right. So where are we going this week for the Haunted Spotlight?
This week, let me ask you guys, do you like pirate stories?
Love pirate stories.
Pirate stories? All right. Well, this week we are going to go to Ocracoke Island in North Carolina. Okay, this is Panic D number 1863. It is an island tucked away on North Carolina's Outer Banks on the southern tip of Hatteras Island. The island itself is only 9.6 square miles, and the average height of the island is less than 5 feet above sea level. The population was 948 as of the 2010 census, and it has over 80 family cemeteries. Now, it is reported that there are more dead on the island than living. The island is only accessible by ferry and small private plane. Has a small private plane airstrip. Many of the houses on the island were actually built from wood salvaged from shipwrecks. So for some of the history and stories of the island, I'm going to turn it on over to Marianne.
Hi, guys.
Hello.
The history of Ocracoke Island actually begins with an early Italian explorer, Giovanni di Verrazzano. He happened upon this island all the way back in 1524. In 1585, someone that you guys might remember from history class, Sir Walter Raleigh's ship, the Tiger, actually showed up there when they were searching for the Roanoke Island, but they instead accidentally collided with a sandbar in Ocracoke Inlet, and he was forced to land on the island for repairs, so he hung up on Ocracoke for a while. However, the remote Ocracoke Island was not permanently settled until 1750, and actually until they put in Route 12 not that recently, I think it was in the 1940s, most people didn't even go there at all, ever. So it's pretty much the way it always was. It was also, as Sean was mentioning and alluding to, a favorite of Edward Teach, who is better known as the pirate Blackbeard, who was actually killed here in November of 1718. The island is also home to a British cemetery. During World War II, German submarines sank several British ships, including the HMT Bedfordshire. And the bodies of the British sailors that were on board were actually washed ashore. They were collected by the locals, and they were buried in a cemetery on the island, which is 2,290 square feet. In this particular cemetery, there is a British flag that is flown at all times. So that's the history of the island. Now for some ghost stories. The first ghost story is about a lighthouse keeper. The lighthouse on the island was built in 1823 and is the second oldest lighthouse still in operation in the United States. And it is home to a ghost lighthouse keeper. An old lighthouse keeper with black and gray striped pants and a white shirt is often seen around the island and its lighthouse. He is said to have long hair tied back with a string and a full heavy beard. He's also been known to walk straight through people and is said that he appears to be solid living person until the point he actually walks through you. There's also a lighthouse keeper who paces, allegedly, the upper floor of a vintage bread and breakfast. Now, is this the same lighthouse keeper? I don't know. Another ghost that's found on the island is Theodosia Burr Alston. Theodosia was the beloved daughter of another one of our history lessons, Aaron Burr. She lost her life when a ship she was on sank off the coast of North Carolina's Outer Banks. Over the years, people have claimed to have seen her, often in the vicinity of the Ocracoke Lighthouse. And she is seen in a long white flowing dress, and often she's dripping wet with water and even has seaweed in her hair. People also claim that when they see her, they smell a strong, musty smell. Now, there's also another girl that they see on the island, but she is unknown. She's described as a very pretty girl in a light blue, long dress, and she's also been seen near the lighthouse. But no one has ever been able to figure out who she is. But she's quite often seen walking, especially in evenings after summer thunderstorms. And she has waved at people and even talked to some of them. But then she simply vanishes, and people are left wondering where this pretty girl went to. It's said she has dark hair and olive skin and a beautiful smile. Some of the people that have seen her walking with a lantern. Most of them say that when they are seeing her, she actually talks to them and talks to them about a party that's going to be happening that night. But when they start to question her about what party, she just up and vanishes. Now, there's a flaming ship story as well. Legend says that every September, on the first night of the new moon, a flaming ship sails past the coast of Ocracoke. The ghostly light is from an old sailing vessel that brought refugees from the Rhine Valley to the New World in the early 1700s. Now, while anchored off the coast there, the crew mutilated and robbed all of the immigrants of their valuables, and then they set the ship on fire, pulled up the anchor, and abandoned her. The vessel then drifted out to sea, but the screams of its passengers could be heard from miles away. And today, no matter which direction or velocity of the wind, when people see this vessel flaming and fiery in the water, it always moves swiftly towards the northeast, accompanied by an eerie wailing sound. Now, sometimes there's also reports of beach fire that sort of disappear. Along the beach, just down the street from the lighthouse, people have often found that there was a fire that they can see burning from a distance. But when they get to it, they can never really find this fire. When they try to walk over to it, it just cannot be found. But some people make a claim that this is the campfire of our friend the pirate Blackbeard, because this little beach was one of his favorite spot on Ocracoke Island. So let's talk a little bit about Blackbeard. Blackbeard, who is really Edward Teach, is Ocracoke's most famous ghost. He's seen all over the village of Ocracoke, including that little beach just down the street from the lighthouse. People have seen him there walking on the beach and thought someone was actually in a pirate costume. Some have tried to talk to him, but he just walks straight past them without even saying a word. Now, on November 21st of 1718, the Royal Navy, sent by Governor Spotswood of Virginia, took two sloops and went after the pirates. Blackbeard and his pirates were captured off the coast of Ocracoke Island, and there was a furious battle with those pirates, and they fought for their lives. But the Royal Navy, led by Royal Navy Lieutenant Maynard, was successful, and they were able to kill most of the pirates, including the infamous pirate Blackbeard. Legend has it that Blackbeard was shot 5 times and stabbed 20 times in this fight when he was actually killed by Lieutenant Maynard. Then Lieutenant Maynard cut off his head and had his body thrown overboard. The head of Blackbeard was hung from the bowsprit of the ship, and legend says that when the head of Blackbeard was cut off and the body was thrown overboard, the body actually swam around the ship 3 times before it sank out of sight beneath the ocean waves. There's a story on Ocracoke Island that the headless body of Blackbeard washed ashore a few days later, and people who were friendly to the pirate took his body and buried it on the beach that he loved to walk on in a hidden location. And there have been reports ever since of a headless man being seen on this beach and in nearby areas. He's most often seen on full moon nights, and people quite often see him walking along and then realize this person has no head. It's said that the headless body of Blackbeard wanders up and down the beaches of Ocracoke Island looking for his head, or maybe for hidden treasure. Apparently, he placed a lot of treasure and hid it somewhere on Ocracoke Island, and they think that the headless ghost is also trying to protect this treasure. Now, many people for hundreds of years have searched the beaches of Ocracoke, but they've never found Blackbeard's hidden treasure. There have been many, many storms over the years, and it's only 5 feet above sea level, so if it ever existed, it's probably been covered up and will probably never be found. But in March of 1961, after a large storm, that next morning, they found many gold coins that were washed up and down the beach shore, and they think that it might have been some of Blackbeard's gold. It turned out they were Spanish gold coins from the time of Blackbeard, but no one was able to actually substantiate that they were actually gold coins that were from him. Now, his ship is also reported to be seen burning in the waters between Cape Hatteras Island and the ferry boat landing on the upper end of Ocracoke Island. It is often reported to be in roaring flames, and people see it and often think that the real ship actually out there burning. But people over the years claim that Blackbeard's Queen Anne's Revenge is still burning in the waters there. Some other ghost stories that we're researching that we've heard about but don't have things to substantiate are shipwrecked sailors being buried in unmarked graves who rise up to haunt the late-night beachgoers, a four-masted schooner that wrecks nearby and the entire crew just mysteriously disappears, the ghost of the island Mad Mag Howard, who was branded by a hot flat iron on her forehead, who prowls the graveyards at midnight, another woman who was unfortunately buried alive, and somehow we know that she turned over in her grave. She continues to prey on passersby. An old diver who haunts the lane near the British cemetery, shuffles unsteadily, according to people, in a diving suit and brass helmet. A murdered woman whose throat was split, wandering the halls of a historic inn. And someone who keeps a casket propped up in her parlor, someone named Fanny Wahab. and a skeleton who has no fingertips called Uncle Evan, who threatens anyone who walks by his grave late at night. Well, that's the ghost stories of the island.
So again, that is Panic D number 1863. So far, we have 9 claims cataloged in there. We have some more that we got to research there to get added to the claims as well. We want to find some more stories to back that up. But that concludes this week's Haunted Spotlight.
There are quite a number of paranormal stories that go along with that area. Wow, I was impressed.
Yeah, and most of them really around that lighthouse.
Yeah.
Yeah, they actually, there's somebody there, like if somebody would visit there, there's somebody giving ghost tours, probably hook up with them and they walk you around. But the island, we've been there, it's really not that big. It's 10 miles, you know, so it's very interesting, very cool place to go if you ever get a chance to get there. And the only way to get there is by ferry or a small little plane, but it's quite an interesting place.
Yeah, I love it there. It was actually an accident on our honeymoon. We weren't supposed to stay there, but we got delayed on Cape Hatteras' ferry getting there and across, and we ended up having to stay there, and it was just awesome.
It sounds like a beautiful place and a nice place to go to for a little summer vacation. Check it out.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, I have another place added to my bucket list that I've got to go visit now. Thanks,
right?
Guys.
Okay. Here we go.
I'm going to be broke by the end of my career. I'm going to spend all this money going to all these places, the cool places that you guys talk about. Very cool. Well, another great place, thanks to the good folks there at Dark Shadow Ghost Tours and Panic D, Sean and Marianne Donnelly. Thank you for joining us tonight for another edition of the Haunted Spotlight. And you guys have anything coming up in the next few weeks? Any events that you want to plug?
Actually, we do. Actually, I have one thing that we just wrapped up, but listeners can still participate in this. This weekend, for 3 days, we actually did an investigation at the J.C. Thompson building in East Liverpool. Now, last night, we did an all-night vigil investigation, and we broadcast that live over YouTube, our DVRs, and then we broke in and
kind
said what was going on and that kind of thing. But that is actually posted out on our YouTube channel, on Dark Shadow Ghost Tours YouTube channel. People can actually go to that and watch it. It's like
4 hours long, but
it's like 4 hours, but you can watch the DVRs, and if you see anything, leave a comment as to what time, you know, if you saw a mist or dust or anything like that, something that we missed. That's going to be out there for a while, so if people want to kind of bored and want to go watch that, and if they see anything, post to it. Now, coming up in the next couple of weeks, our entire team is going to Gettysburg. And we're going to be investigating various places, including the place where we stay. And we're going to do another live broadcast from there as well that people can actually log in and participate and comment and ask us questions and things like that. That's going to be from the 24th till the following Monday, which I don't know the date off the top of my head. But
The 29th.
We'll have different times where we'll come on the air and do some live broadcasts. So if you follow us on our Facebook page and Twitter and all that stuff, we'll be posting those when those come out online, too.
Fantastic.
Yeah, very cool.
Well, thanks for stopping by, guys. We've got to go to our commercial break, but we do appreciate you each and every second week of the month. Well, bi-weekly, I should say, every 2 weeks of the month, we'll have you here with us to do the Haunted Spotlight. Throw out your website addresses for everybody so they can stop by and visit.
PanicD.com and DarkShadowGhostTours.com.
Thank you very much, Sean and Marianne Donnelly, for the Haunted Spotlight this week. And we'll catch you folks again next week, or in 2 weeks, actually, here at BTE Radio. You guys have a great night. Thanks again.
Thank you.
There they go off into the darkness, Sean and Marianne Donnelly, from Dark Shadow Ghost Tours and Panic D with the Haunted Spotlight, this week here at BTE Radio. Marie, it's break time, And we do have to take a break and take care of our sponsors. And our guest is waiting in the wings. We're going to be talking about Ted Bundy tonight, The Ted Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, and his other book from Wild Blue Press. It's Kevin Sullivan's Vampire, The Richard Chase Murders. Looking forward to that tonight. And it's going to be a fun show, Marie.
Yeah, it is. Like I said, I've been waiting for this one.
Me too. Before we go to break real quick, I'm not going to give it away this week because we don't have enough time to do it this week, but we're going to be giving away two very cool prizes for the third and fourth weeks of Serial Killer Month. I keep saying cereal as in, like, bowl of cereal. we're going to be giving away a two DVD set, and the DVD is called America's Serial Killers, Portraits and Evil. It's a 10-part journey into darkness, and it is a documentary drama kind of series, and it has 10 programs to the two DVD set, and they cover such notorious serial killers as Jack the Ripper, H.H. Holmes, who we've talked about, the Boston Strangler, Ed Gein, the Zodiac Killer, the Son of Sam, just to name a few. There's so many serial killers they spotlight in this two DVD set. So next week on the show, I'll be giving away one DVD there and one on the fourth week of the show, and we'll give you details how to win those. So make sure you keep listening to BTE Radio. We're going to go ahead and jump into our break and make way for our guest, Kevin M. Sullivan, who's going to be joining us in just a few minutes. To visit his website, go to our website, beyondtheedgeradio.com. There's a link for his website there, plus a bio right on the main page and information all about Kevin. So check that out. We'll be back after the break with Serial Killer Month as it continues here at BTE Radio.
Pull the covers over your head and pray for morning. Back.
Have you ever wanted to spruce up the marketing material for your business? Have you ever wanted to turn those memories you have on slides or VHS tapes into DVDs? Have you ever wanted to create the perfect personalized video for a loved one? Then look no further. The sky is the limit with Chumbucket Studios. Anything is possible because it all begins with a little imagination. Please visit www.chumbucketstudios.com for more information.
Visit the National Museum of Mysteries and Research Center today.
ZAM as a physical building opened about 5 years ago. I wanted to open a research center, a library where people could come and talk about the unexplained, research different phenomena. We have over 1,500 books where people can come and browse through all day. We have newspaper clippings on the ghost phenomena, Bigfoot phenomena, UFO, and other unexplained things where they can research as well. We have all the ghost hunting tools. We have Bigfoot casts, a lot of pop culture stuff on Bigfoot, as well as Casper, E.T., Ghostbusters. Well, we have newspaper accounts of the men in black, which were associated with UFOs. Over the years, you know, people claim to have taken photographs of ghosts and such, ectoplasm. Most people are fascinated with the unexplained. That's what the museum was for, but it's also for skeptics, too. The museum's not about to convince people that these things happen, that it is real. It's believe it or not. We have monthly lectures that helps fund the museum. Oftentimes it's me lecturing on something I've investigated or my research. And other times we have outside speakers come in and host book signings and such. The museum's at 301 Locust Street in Columbia, Pennsylvania, right off of the beaten path. When people come here, they love it, they enjoy it, and they go back and tell their friends, and their friends visit. Come to the museum, I think you'll enjoy it. It's a really weird place.
The National Museum of Mysteries and Research Center will be expecting you. Can't wait for Halloween to be scared? Coming this June to York, Pennsylvania, Phenomenology 107, the largest and most popular paranormal conference on the planet, returns for its seventh straight year. Come meet some of the top paranormal researchers and experiencers in the field.
attend lectures by the real-life survivors of some of the most notorious hauntings in American history that inspired blockbuster movies such as The Conjuring, Haunting in Connecticut, and the Amityville Horror. Phenomenology 107 is coming to York, Pennsylvania, June 18th through the 21st at the York Holiday Inn and Conference Center. Tickets are now available at www.phenomevents.com. That's phenomevents.com. Happy haunting.
Carl Sagan once wrote that the questioning mind needs to be instilled with both skepticism and wonder, for the universe is a pretty big place, filled with undelved mysteries, sciences, and life that we've barely begun to comprehend. Every month, Intrepid Magazine brings you both the wondrous and the skeptical. Intrepid Magazine focuses on science, metaphysics, UFOs, politics, conspiracies, and unexplained phenomena, all offered up by Intrepid's cadre of writers and contributors, comprised of a host of seasoned authors, pundits, and recognized names in their fields. The universe is indeed a big place, and where other magazines leave off, Intrepid Mag is just beginning. Subscribe to Intrepid Magazine today at www.intrepidmag.com. That's www.intrepidmag.com.
To BTE Radio. Get ready, because the sh** is about to get real.
And good evening and welcome back to tonight's program. This is BTE Radio, and that's short for Beyond the Edge Radio, and we are live here on the Para X Radio Network. WAHR-FM, a Midwest radio productions, Radio Love, and you can visit them at radiolove.com, Planet Paranormal, TuneIn Radio, and of course, if it's Wednesday night, you're listening to the rebroadcast of our show on the IPBN-FM Intrepid Paradigm Broadcast Network. My name is Eric Altman, your host and producer of tonight's show, and we want to welcome everybody to BT Radio. It's Serial Killer Month. My co-host and I, we're loving it. Marie Samuels, I know she's digging it. It's one of my favorite subjects. Marie, what do you think?
My favorite subject.
Well, hands down.
It is.
We had a great guest on the show last week with Jeff Mudgett joining us. We talked about his great-great-grandfather, H.H. Holmes, one of America's first notorious serial killers, and the murder castle there in Chicago. It was a great program, a lot of positive feedback on that show, and we had a lot of fun talking with Jeff.
Jeff's fun.
He is. And tonight, we're honored to have another great guest joining us on the program. He is an author, and he writes for wildbluepress.com. You can check out the website, wildbluepress.com. And he is an eclectic author. He's written on a variety of subjects, and we have him with us tonight to talk about two of the books that he's written about, The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, and Vampire, The Richard Chase Murders. And you can find them on the website wildbluepress.com. Let's welcome to the show Kevin M. Sullivan. Good evening, Kevin, and thank you for joining us here at BTE Radio.
Well, thank you guys for having me. I've been looking forward to coming on the show.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours, Kevin. We're glad that you're with us tonight. And before we get into talking about your work and writing these true crime books, let's learn a little bit about you. Tell us about your background and why you got interested in writing true crime.
Okay, my main work for my life has been in the Christian ministry. I was ordained back in 1984 after going to school for a number of years, and so I have been a minister for over 30 years. But I've had an interest in true crime ever since I was a boy, and in fact, the first adult book that I read, I was 10 years old. I pulled a book off my father's shelf. His library in our home, and it was Charles Franklin's The World's Worst Murderers. And it was this was 1965, and like I say, I was 10, and that book came out, I think, simultaneously in the UK and the US. And Franklin is an English author, and so he covered a bunch of cases. Well, you know, I was fascinated just really by the book, and then, as I grew up, I kept reading true crime. I would read things about war. My father was a World War II veteran. His brother was killed in the war. His uncle was killed in the war. So I had an interest there. I would learn about history, you know, within the family. So I always seemed to be drawn to these cataclysmic events. Well, I never thought I would be writing anything. I went into the ministry, and I spent years there. I wrote a book back in 95, which turned out to be my first book, and it was called Shattering the Myth, Signposts on Custer's Road to Disaster. It was a fairly brief personality study on George Armstrong Custer. But it sold well, albeit on a small scale. It was a fairly small press run, but it did very well. And I thought by doing that, I could get the desire of writing out of my system, but it never went away. It just increased. And so I began writing. Since that time, I've written, I'm just really finishing up my 10th book now. And as far as books, I've also, back in the early 2000s, there was a paper, a newspaper here in Louisville, started here, called Snitch. It was a great venue for true crime writers. It was a weekly print newspaper that was published here in Louisville. Then there was a Lexington, Kentucky edition, and it ended up being in four other states. So it had a five-state run. And I wasn't on staff with Snitch, but I would sell them articles. Since I was doing a lot of researching of, you know, Kentucky murders, and I would periodically sell them some things, okay? And whenever they ran my stuff, you know, this would be front page stuff. And it was a great venue for writers and a very unique newspaper. And it was print. So they are out of business. The last thing I wrote for them was in 2005 when I wrote something to do with, and this actually led me into writing the book on the Bundy murders. I had the opportunity in 2005 to meet Jerry Thompson. He was the lead detective out of Utah. He is a friend. He was a friend of my friend, James Massey. And Jim asked me to come to dinner and meet Jerry. And I knew Jerry was involved in the Bundy case in Utah. Well, that turned into an article for Snitch because Jerry had brought Ted Bundy's murder kit with him. But it did a lot more than that. It was so surreal having Ted Bundy's murder kit in my home. Jerry Thompson and his wife were here in Louisville for like a couple of days, and they turned this bag over to Jim because they knew Jim was interested in the case, and they went sightseeing in Louisville. And he brought the bag just to show Jim. I asked Jim if I could bring it to our house, and you know, I called my wife. I had this murder kit in my hand. I placed it in the passenger seat beside me. And I was on my way home, and I called my wife, and I said, "Honey, would you please clear everything off the dining room table? I'm bringing Ted Bundy's murder kit into the house, and I'd like some room to photograph everything, and I just want to let you know what I'm doing." Okay, so she wasn't too pleased with the idea of the murder kit coming into the home. Okay, that's the way women are. But I photographed all this stuff. It was one of the most surreal things that really, really ever happened to me. But before Jerry left, he gave me, and he gave Jim, one of the large Glad trash bags from Ted's car. And Ted had that was a part of his murder kit because all of his victims were left nude. And the only thing they have on would be like a beaded necklace. And he would use those trash bags to put their clothes in and other personal belongings. And then that would be dumped in a dumpster somewhere down the road away from the body. And so he gave me one of these. And so this, you know, I am holding and having in my home. Plus I had him write a letter of authentication, which was smart. And so I've got this bag in my home, and I thought, well, I'll write this article for Snitch. But I started delving. I thought, no, I think I want to write a book about this guy. And so I went down that road with that, and the book ultimately became The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History. And that really was the book that put me on the map as a true crime writer. A lot of people got to know me through that book and other well-known writers. And so it was a really good move. But I had people telling me early on, don't write that book. And there's too many books out on Bundy. I thought, well, no, I got this desire. Sometimes you got to go with what you know mm-hmm. on the inside, even though there's voices on the outside telling you no. Mm-hmm. And I remember being about halfway through the book, and I was finding out things, a lot of information about some of these murders and about just a lot of new information about the case that had never come to the surface that ended up being in my book, you know, the first time in print. And I remember being halfway through the book, and I thought, you know, I thought I could write a good book on this guy. I had no idea. I was unearthing new evidence, which, you know, is really something with a case that old. So that book was published in 2009. And so, you know, I consider myself a writer of true crime and history, basically. But most people know me through true crime because of not just Snitch and mostly because of the Bundy murders, but I also wrote for a time on an online site that was very popular, had a lot of great well-known writers called In Cold Blog. And I wrote for them for a short time, and then that went out. And Snitch finally ceased publication, I think, at the end of 2005. And that's when that article about meeting Thompson came out. So, you know, and I've got a book coming out in the fall called God, the Devil, the Supernatural, and You. So I write about a variety of subjects that has to do with a lot of things that are in my life as a minister that have to do with the supernatural that's been going on for a long time. Anyway, so, you know, but mostly I'm a writer of true crime and history, but that gives you a pretty good background on me. So I kind of like to call myself the man with feet in both worlds, because it is not often, because I know a lot of ministers, it's not often you'll run into guys like me that do that world, the world of the ministry, and then write true crime and history. Usually right. people do one or the other, but they don't often do both. And so that gives you some background on me.
And, you know, you said that you were discovering new evidence as you were writing the book.
Yes.
What was some of the new evidence that you uncovered?
Well, this was very interesting. Here's one aspect. You have to remember, when I was gathering evidence, I considered myself a novice. Now, I mean, I wasn't kidding you. When I decided to write this book, I knew it would be kind of grueling. I knew it would require 24/7 kind of stuff. I knew it would last a couple of years, and I would be a very, very, very busy man. And I was contacting people, contacting detectives. I was obtaining case files. I was talking to friends of Bundy that he used to work with. But the new information would come out of the lives of the detectives, these guys who were still with us. And one thing that I really found interesting, most people that know about the Bundy case will be familiar with the name William Hagemeyer, or Bill Hagemeyer. He was a behavioral science guy, you know, unit guy, a special agent with the FBI that worked in that psychological program of, you know, where they pick apart killers' minds and
right.
try to profile
profiler them. Yeah.
Yes, yes. And now Hagemeyer became, quote, friends, unquote, friends with Bundy the last couple of years of his life. And they really did have a good relationship. And I remember Bill told me some people saw their FBI agents kind of criticized them because they thought he was getting too buddy-buddy with Ted. And I thought, well, what planet, and I told Bill this, what planet are they on? Because if you want to get in good with somebody to get information, that's what you have to do.
Yeah.
Anyway, what made this whole thing interesting is as Bundy was coming to the end of his life, and he'd already been, you know, working with Bill Hagemeyer, and he liked and trusted him, he asked Bill if he could confess everything to him. Hagemeyer said, no, you've got to confess to the detectives from the various states that need to come in here and hear about these murders.
Was it five states total?
Yeah, well, no, probably six states, and it could be more than that.
Okay.
But Bundy said, you're probably talking about six states, and that's probably correct, although there could be a homicide here or there in other states, like that he may not have included. Here's the thing about Bundy. They think about 36 were killed by Bundy. But I think that total probably goes a little bit higher. And I'll tell you why. He wouldn't always tell who he killed. Sometimes he would confess as to who he killed. Sometimes he wouldn't. One thing he never liked to do is to talk about the murder of underage girls. You know, he is a co-ed killer. He killed college women. We know that.
Right.
He apparently wasn't embarrassed to admit that. But he killed a couple 12-year-old girls that we know of. But he didn't want to talk about them so much. But one of the girls he thought was a little bit older, and he did talk about her. But Hagemeyer, and here's where some new information comes in, Hagemeyer sat in on every confession Bundy made. So I called Bill one day, and I said, you know, I was already on speaking terms with Bill and most of the lead detectives in the case. Because of how I treat these people and because I always do what I say, I got a good reputation, and they usually will talk to me. I only had one detective, and even he still talked to me. But he was a little wondered why I was even interested in this case. But most of the lead detectives is very open with me. Just, I mean, you know, and they trust me. And that's what you got to do when you're trying to hunt out information. So I never betrayed that trust. They gave me email addresses, phone numbers. I never gave it out to anybody else, even though other people asked me. I didn't do it.
Right.
But I called him one day. I said, Bill, I got the name of a girl, Lynette Culver, from Idaho, who was murdered by Bundy. And the only thing I have is her name and her manner of death. She was drowned in the bathtub. And he said to me, and I know he sat in on every confession, I got this from a Colorado investigator, this information. He said, well, when I told him who told me that, which was Mike Fisher out of Colorado, he said, well, I got a lot of respect for Mike, and I do. He said, but I don't know anything about that. And he said, you do understand, Kevin, right? He said that Bundy liked to kill these women while having sex with them from behind, either anal or vaginal, while he choked them to death. I said, yeah, Bill, I'm aware of that. But the information I got is that he happened to kill Lynette Culver in the bathtub of the Holiday Inn. And he said, well, I don't know anything about that. I said, well, I'll tell you what, Bill, if I can get the straights of this, I'll contact you. He said, because I've not heard that story. Now, at the time, I'm a novice. I'm figuring this out. I'm thinking, well, maybe Mike made a mistake. I said, I got to find out now because he sat in all of them. So I called Mike up, Mike Fisher. Mike goes, well, I got that. He said, Russ Renault was coming out of the room with Bundy. And when Russ and Randy Everett, these two investigators out of Idaho, were talking to Bundy for an hour, when they were coming out, he said, Renault pulled me to the side and gave me some information about how Bundy had killed Lynette Culver, that he drowned in a bathtub. Now, that didn't, I'm sorry. I actually get ahead of myself. This was after he found out, not immediately after Mike was coming out of the room with him. This was like an hour or so later after he found out. So I was getting ahead of myself. So he told him what happened. And this is why Hagemeyer does not know it. When they got out of the original, they only had an hour, and it was Bundy, Bill Hagemeyer, who was just there to watch, and Bundy's attorney. I think her name is Diane Wiener. They were covering two cases. One was the girl that Bundy killed, who was a hitchhiker when he was on his way moving to Utah. And then also, and that was in September of 1974, and then Lynette Culver, and he got Culver in May of 75. Now, when he was taught, they were going back and forth because they only had an hour. Bundy happened to mention when Renault said to Ted, how did she die? He said, drowning. But he also mentioned he threw her into the, I think it was the Snake River. And so they were kind of figuring she drowned in the Snake River, but as they were walking out, okay, and I guess Mike Fisher was going in to his meeting, and then they would talk after Mike came out of his meeting, as they were waiting in the parking lot, and Russ told me the whole place was filled with, you know, TV news trucks and all kinds of things, and they were trying to keep everything kind of hush-hush. He said to his co-investigator, Randy Everett, he said, you know, Bundy said she drowned, but he never said how she drowned. Could you go back in the prison and see if they'll let you talk to Ted? So Everett went back in. They said, yeah, you can see him. They sat Everett down in a room. 15, 20 minutes later, Bundy came in. Bundy sits down, and they start talking about Culver. And he said, how did she die? He said, she drowned. Bundy said, oh, well, I drowned her in the bathtub.
And then he admitted
to Everett. He said, and then after I drowned her, I had sex with her. So, you know, that was, you know, he had this love for necrophilia. And he would have sex with these women before they died, as they were dying, and after they were dead. And he used to love the changing. I think that's called the cyanotic hue. And you see that discoloration of the fingernails and the change in skin, and that's like the freshly dead kind of thing. But he could, his love of necrophilia would go on. I mean, he could revisit, you know, grave sites and have sex with them, or even remove heads. At one point in Washington State, he had as many as 4 heads with him in his apartment, and those were used for sexual purposes. But with this girl, he drowned her in the bathtub, so he admitted it. And then he dumped her in the Snake River. Now, I asked Everett if he said anything else, and did you get any other information from him? He said, I tried to get some additional information about the girl he killed, the hitchhiker, you know, back in September of 74, but he really didn't have anything else. He really had said everything in the confession of what he needed to say. Well, Bill Hagemeyer was not present when this second meeting came out, happened. So when I told Bill about it later, he was a little upset because technically he should have been there, and so should Bundy's attorney. That was one thing. But, you know, there's also new information that came out about the killing of Julie Cunningham, which has never, you know, before been published. Mike Fisher gave me the information on it. He tried to give it to me in a certain way, and then just call her a Colorado victim. But I had done my homework, and I know how these women died. I just didn't know how Julie died. And I said to Mike, I know you're talking about Julie Cunningham. And there was silence, and he said, yeah, that's correct. I said, listen, my publisher is not going to want me to not identify her. And I said, so I want you to think about that, and if it's okay with you, I'd like to go ahead and do it. And it's a pretty expensive story. I mean, there's a lot of information as to how he killed her and what he did prior to her death. And that's never been out before. So that came out. There was information that came out about the murder of the girl from Michigan, the nurse from Michigan. It slips my mind now. Karen Campbell. Who came with Dr. Godowsky and his children and disappeared from the Wildwood Inn. He confessed also to Fisher some things about that and what he did. And so that was in the book. And so there's information, new information about the murders, and a whole lot of information about the case in general. Also, because of how he kidnapped Debbie Kent and some things that happened there. And I don't do this very often, but I speculate on why certain things happened to Bundy the night he kidnapped Debbie Kent from the play in Bountiful, Utah. Just some small things about it that really had to have gone down that way, as opposed to some way some other people thought that it might have gone down based on how Bundy was and how he appeared to some people towards the end of him being there that evening. So I think he actually abducted this girl, whacked her on the head, and put her back in the car and went back into the theater. So I'm kind of doing a long, convoluted thing, but I'm trying to give you an area of where a lot of things came out about the murder. So so it was a good thing to see that occur. And that was a nice selling point as well. And I don't mean just the murders, but having the new information. And also, most of the Bundy books, because they were done so early, so recent after these things occurred, kind of write from a perspective of the girls are disappearing and they don't know who it is. And my book is different. People reading my book, you actually follow the trail of Ted Bundy. It is very chronological, and reviewers have picked up on that. And they've also talked about how I have really painted a good picture on his descent into madness. When he was killing in the Northwest, he was a far superior killer than what he was by the time he got to Florida. And anyway, and, you know, we can talk about that. But so that's, you know, the new information, just a whole. And I think the passage of time has caused people to open up more now than they would have when the wounds were more open and more raw, as it were.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And yeah, it does. And I believe that given the age of these investigators, if somebody doesn't write another biography of Bundy in the next 10 years or so, mine will be the last biography written about Bundy using so many of the original sources. I don't just mean case files, but the testimony of the detectives who lived through it. And there's an interesting thing about the Bundy case. Washington State has done everything they can to save everything from that case. And they've done an excellent job at the King County Archives. In the Florida State Archives, they've done the same thing as well. This is not the case in Utah. You can't hardly find anything. Jerry Thompson was able to take not just the murder kit with him when he left, but he took the case file. And when I was in Utah, I first interviewed Jerry here in Louisville back in 2000 and the spring of 2005. That's when he brought the Bundy bag. But then when I knew I was going to write the book, my wife and I traveled out to Utah in August of 2006. And Jerry and I had a sit-down meeting, a really good time. And, he provided me with copies of the case file, Bundy's gas records, his own personal notes, all his reports. And when I went to the Third District Court, not that I needed it, but when I went to the Third District Court to take a look at the trial transcript of the Carol DeRoche, this is the only woman that got away from him, whoever escaped murder. And that's what Bundy was convicted of, in 1976, was in the attempted kidnapping of Carol DeRoche. And they destroy, this is just the way they do it. They destroy the trial transcripts of every case after 9 years. So I said to the court clerk, I said, you're telling me that a case this infamous, you all don't hold on to? I said, nope.
Wow.
You destroy them. And that's weird. Now, it doesn't mean that the family of Judge Hanson, who was involved in that case, he died last year. It doesn't mean that there aren't a few of those transcripts, remaining. But I'll tell you this, 20, 30 years from now, if somebody wants to write a book on Ted Bundy and they bebop over to Utah, they're not going to find anything. They'll find very little.
That's a
shame.
Which
is a real hole in the case if you don't have this. I was very fortunate to have this stuff. And I've got thousands and thousands of pages of case files. And I may end up contacting the King County Archives just to see if they want Jerry Thompson's case file, because I don't believe they have that.
I think you should, so, and anyway, I think they will.
Huh?
I said I think you should, and I think they will.
I think they will. Yes, I do. And it was an interesting case to write about. You know, it's funny when you write a book, when you write a biography, you know, if Bundy could come back from the dead right now, he and I could sit down, I could discuss his life from the time of a little baby all the way up to toddler, teenagers, what schools he went to, you know, what his siblings, how he was, you know, with them, his friends, off to high school, the, you know, the murders and all that. It's just the way it is. When you write a biography, you get to know your subject well. You also get to know the victims when you're dealing with crime. You get to know them very well. I feel like I know these people, and yet I've never met them, you know? And but it stays with you.
Right.
It just stays with you. For the rest of my life, I'll carry this case on the inside of me. I mean, it's down in book form, and that's a wonderful thing. But I carry internally all of this stuff. It doesn't grieve me. I don't mean like that. It's just a special thing that you have, and you become a part of that. It's almost kind of mystical, but it's really just the way it is.
Yeah. Well, let me take a quick break for our second here and remind our listeners that we're listening to the Para X Radio Network, WAHR-FM, a Midwest Radio Productions, Radio Love, Planet Paranormal, and TuneIn Radio. And if you're listening Wednesday night, you're listening to the replay of the show on the IPBN-FM network. Our guest tonight, Kevin M. Sullivan, and we're talking about true crime during Serial Killer Month here on the show. And our first topic of discussion tonight is The Bundy Murders, A Comprehensive History, a book that Kevin has written about Ted Bundy. And we're speaking about Ted Bundy right now. We'll be talking about Richard Chase in just a few minutes and the vampire killer himself. I do have a question for you, Kevin. I'm curious to know, looking back on this case, and I know Ted admitted to a lot of these murders, but he also, there was a lot of murders that he didn't admit to, and there's thought that it's possible links to, I believe I've read almost 200 possible victims that they speculate he could have been responsible for. After his execution, were there any other victims they found that they were able to tie to him being responsible for?
There have been a couple women, I can't, now their names escape me, they had disappeared in Washington State around the same time, and they felt pretty sure that he was the one that did it. And I think they did some DNA testing, and they ruled him out on a couple of these murders. Can't remember the girls' names. Now, all the detectives are certain he killed more than what he admitted. I mean, for example, Bundy could be real shut mouth about certain things. He came out and admitted to Bob Keppel that he killed 11 in Washington State, but he only gave the names of 8. He admitted to 8 in Utah, but only gave the names of 5. And, you know, a couple of those names came right at the end. I mean, right at the end after his head was shaved and he was on his way to the electric chair, he stopped and asked for a recorder and gave a couple additional names. So here's the terrible thing about women and murder. As I said, I got thousands of case files. When I was obtaining these, I would also get lists of missing and murdered women from states where Bundy operated and from adjoining states. And, you know, he is just not doing them all. He's just not. And there were killers active in California. He admitted to killing one in California. And he may have killed more than one, but he did admit to killing one. But the funny thing about it is he was not the only serial killer out there operating. And now some people think that he may have killed upwards of 100. I think that is ludicrous. Even Bundy said, you know, to do the amount that he's confessed to doing, like 36, 30, whatever, that's a lot of people to kill. I still think it goes a little bit higher because there were some things he just didn't want to talk about. Now, he may have killed Anne Marie Burr, was an 8-year-old little girl when he was 14. He may have done that. Usually he denied that murder. However, in a conversation with Ron Holmes, criminologist, who Bundy was getting kind of thick with towards the end of his life until they had a falling out. He admitted that he did that, and he spoke to Holmes about it in the third person. And Holmes told me that, and I also found it in an article in the Tacoma News Tribune in, like, their Metro section.
Right.
From, like, 1986, 87, it's in my book. And he alludes to it, and he does something that's really, I don't quote the whole article, but from what Bundy said, I just got to think he killed this girl. You know, he talks about the person that they were looking at was also involved with murders in Lake Sammamish. Well, that's him.
Yep.
He also talked about whoever this person was that killed her may have taken her to the orchard, this little orchard next to this girl's house, and strangled her and killed her there and then had sex with her afterwards. Well, my God, that's Bundy's M.O. So could he have killed Emery Burr, no matter what denials were later? Yes, he could have. He also may have killed in 69, maybe, maybe not. He may have killed in 72. He probably killed in 63. I mean, not 63, 73.
66.
And he might have killed in 66. He might have done the...
Trumbull and Wick.
Well, here's the thing about that. I'll tell you something interesting. He was in that area then, but I'll tell you what's weird about that murder. That murder looks more like the Chi Omega murder.
Where it was like a frenzy?
Yeah. Now, Chi Omega was a result, and if you ever get a chance to read my book, you'll see how he descends into somebody that's really unrecognizable. He's no longer that. And listen, in Washington State, he could draw women in. I mean, he had all these murderous impulses. He was internally salivating what he was going to do to these women, but he wasn't putting out any what they call bad vibes. But in Florida, he could barely get women to talk to him. He went to the discotheque, the disco right next to Chi Omega, and the women would say, man, that guy is creepy. Do you see his eyes? One girl said he's putting out these weird vibes. They just wanted to stay away from him. And then I make a point. He could not get the conscious women, you know, from like, you know, the disco. So he attacked the unconscious women, Chi Omega. And it was a frenzy, beating with that log, beating, you know, just beating.
Four of them.
And yeah. And killed two of them. So I don't know whether he did that trouble thing. It could very well be that he's involved. But if I had to put money, if you said, you know, Kevin, you got to put the money on this, I would put my money in the pot that he didn't do it. But I could be wrong. I would put my money in the pot that he killed Burr, but I could be wrong. Now, so there was, but what made 1974 different? 1974, at the dawn of 1974, he launched himself into the world of murder. And when he did that, he knew he was never going to come off that road. There were no exit ramps. He was going to keep doing it until he was caught or killed. He was waving bye-bye to a career in law, to perhaps becoming governor. He was never going to get married, come home and kiss the wife, kiss the child or children, pet the dog, and sit down and watch the evening news. His life was not going to be that. His life was going to be solitary, and it was going to be a life where he was going to be a predator, be predatorial. And he knew this. And he only was going to maintain the mask to keep this life going. And that's what makes 1974 so extremely different. And if you look at murder, I'm telling you, I have studied a lot about murder and killers. I've never seen anybody quite like Bundy, and I don't really expect to read of anybody like him again. When he got Linda Ann Healy, and you just got to picture this. She lived with other co-eds in a house in Washington, in, you know, Seattle, and they all went to the university there. He came in one night. He crept downstairs. There were two women sleeping downstairs. They weren't separate rooms. The only thing separating Linda Ann Healy from this other, young lady, was a thin plywood piece, full piece of plywood. He came in there, he throttled her and choked her into unconsciousness. He may have hit her, but he probably choked her. She got a nosebleed. He takes her gown off. He hangs it up. He takes the time to make her bed like a military person would do it in basic training. He grabs a backpack. He grabs some clothes. He wraps her up. He carries her up the steps out into the night in an area that is a university district that may have college students out there at 4 o'clock in the morning talking. He puts her in his car, off she goes, and her life is over. This kind of murder is so unusual. It takes hardened investigators. They're going to shake their head at it. What's he do at Lake Sammamish? He exposes himself to thousands of people. He calls himself Ted. He takes one in the morning, Janice Ott, takes her to a secluded place, does whatever he wants to do with her, keeps her alive. He comes back that afternoon. He's still not satiated as a killer, but it's also a homicidal boast going on. And he grabs Denise Naslund. And, I talk about, he didn't feel well. He was nursing a couple. And he probably didn't have a lot to eat that day because it was all about the murder, all about the sexual degradation, all about the building up to destroying these people. And he said to himself, I'm going to go back to the lake and get another victim. And he was hot and he was tired and he was a little edgy. But I said he still knew how to turn on a receptive, turn on the charm when he saw a receptive heart. And, Bundy knew it was a numbers game. Not everybody went with him. But he got Denise Naslund, and off she went with him. And, of course, he killed, he did whatever sexual things he wanted to do with her. And then he killed one in front of the other. And can you imagine the terror in the one that had to view this? And, of course, that was just fuel to Bundy. Now, there were times when he would kill, and he wanted them unconscious, and he just wanted to do his thing. But there were times when he would just absorb this terror, that would come off of a person like that. It would just be fuel to him. And if they cry out, that would just be more fuel. I mean, there's nothing they could say or do to save themselves. And then he killed both of them. But he's a very strange person when it comes to, I thought when writing the book, Kevin, if you're going to go out and abduct people, would you do it like that? No. I would find somebody walking along, I'd grab them. Now, he did that too. But who would go into a rooming house with other people and take somebody and cause them to be, knocked down or whatever and carry them up the steps? Who would take two from a lake on the same day in front of tens of thousands of people?
Broad daylight,
broad daylight. Who would go into an auditorium and expose himself to 1,500 people at Dumont High School so he could abduct one of them in the city he was currently living in, where girls were already starting to disappear and people were already on edge? So Bundy, was anything but predictable. And you won't find killers like this. He was really, he thought he could get away with it, and really, for the most part, he did. It was only towards the end that he started really fouling up. And, of course, so he's a strange guy if you study him. And, you just think a guy like this has got to be caught. But no, he wouldn't. He used to love to steal things. He could park his car. He could go into a department store. He did this one day. He took something out of the window. I think it was like a small tree or a plant or something. And he walked out with it. Now, he used to get a real rush. He used to get a real rush by putting himself in harm's way like this. Now, it wasn't murder. He could have been caught for shoplifting or stealing. Right. But he just did that because he enjoyed it. But, you know, this, so, you know, he was just a very, and this mask he wore, I mean, if you look at him, a lot of women thought he was handsome, and he was very articulate. And,
very charming.
Oh, yeah. An academic guy, somebody that's rising in politics in Washington State. So even though there's missing women in Washington State, and of course everybody with a badge knows the girls are dead, but the public at large is saying, gee, they're missing, but we hope they're okay. The cops know they're dead. And, you know, they're, and so, you know, there were women disappearing, and they meet this guy, Bundy. Oh, well, it can't be him. Look, I mean, he just, he's not covered in tattoos. No, I mean, he's not, you know, he doesn't look like a grunge person. He doesn't look like, yeah, which are really the guy from the other
volunteered for the suicidal crisis hotline and had a letter of reference from the governor at the time.
Yeah.
Worked for the governor at the time.
Oh, huh?
And he worked for the governor at the time after he was reelected. Dan.
He was involved with various political careers. Not everybody he worked for, made it into office. But Bundy became so well known that he didn't have any problem getting good jobs within, cabinet somewhere, and he worked for the Department of Emergency Services. But the interesting thing about Bundy is that doors were going to open for him. You know, he wasn't from the upper crust of society, but by the time he, got out of school, and of course he's working, the political angle, he was getting to know some very influential people. And so Bundy, if he wouldn't have gone into murder, if he'd been just a normal guy, he probably would have made it into, he'd either gone into law and been very successful, but maybe not really heard of, people wouldn't know him as well, but he might have gone into politics, and with his kind of charisma, he could have become governor perhaps. So he was well liked, and people welcomed him into their circles. And when he was working a campaign, he could work very hard for them. But he didn't like to work jobs so much. He just didn't like to work. But when he felt like he was in like a career and helping somebody to be elected or something, he would throw himself into that.
So I have a couple quick questions before we switch over to Richard Chase.
Okay.
Did Ted Bundy admit that he was a necrophiliac? Or is that just speculation?
No. He did admit to it. He just would always go to it in a roundabout way.
And was it only the women in Washington State?
No. In fact, he kicked it up a notch in Utah.
Because they probably kept better in Utah.
Well, now, he severed heads in Washington State. And
that was my next question. Why was he severing the heads in Washington State and Washington State only?
Well, he may have severed heads in that could have been a phase in Washington State. It's like he was collecting heads. He admitted to Hagemeyer he had four of them. Now that's all he had in his rooming house were those heads. But it appears that it's a fact. I would say it's a fact that he brought two of his victims actually into his apartment in Utah at 565 First Avenue, and then would keep them there. And, I don't know how long they survived or whether he would crack them in the head with his crowbar and a lot of times strike to their skull. And so I don't know how long they would live. And it may be that they were, comatose, but he was bringing entire bodies to his apartment at 565. But now some kills in Washington State, some kills as he traveled, and some kills Utah, wherever, were quick kills. And the necrophilia, if there was going to be that, and really there always would, it would be a quick act or two or three with a body right after he had murdered them, and then he would dispose of them. And there was no going back to. But in Washington State, he had two body dumps, and he had gone back to revisit them. But there were also times when he didn't have to because he had heads in his apartment. So things would change. I don't know if he was severing heads in Washington State, but he sure brought two of them up to his apartment now. So, you know, there was a bit of transformation on how he would deal with these victims. But, yes, he did admit to Bob Keppel that he was fascinated with that, I hope I'm pronouncing this right, this synodic cue or synodic cue of when the, you know, body is no longer breathing and the blood pools and the nails turn darker and just that fresh state of death. So he admitted that. Now, when it came to Keppel questioning him about the murder of George Ann Hawkins, he, you know, grabbed her and went out and into this rural area and, you know, parked his car, killed her soon after he was there. It was probably by that time, maybe midnight. No, I'm sorry, closer to 1 a.m. He admitted staying with her until around 5 a.m., till around dawn. Now, of course, he's having sex with her. When Keppel probed, and Keppel knew what he was doing, when Keppel asked him about that, this is during his end-of-life confessions, he did not want to talk about it. He said, I'll get back with you. I'll get back to you about that later. It's just too hard to talk about now. So he didn't want to readily talk about that, but he did admit that, yes, that necrophilia was a part of it.
And what about cannibalism?
No, he didn't do that.
Okay, I didn't think so.
No, he didn't do that. And, you know, some people, and this is just flat wrong, some people have thought, not the detectives, some just people, readers or whatever, think, well, he killed so many he was so good at, he must have had a partner. Listen, Theodore Bundy would have never shared any of his victims. He would have never done any of that in front of anybody. He was a lone killer. And when he was in that altered state of murder, it was really just between him and that victim. And there were times when he wanted that victim unconscious and just to, I hate to use a word, but to enjoy the moment, undisturbed, not just by anybody, but even by the victim. He would never have been one of these, you know, like tag team killers. And so they're just quite wrong about that. So, yeah.
One last question before we go to break, Kevin.
Yes.
Just recently, within this past week, they released a program on Investigation Discovery called Serial Thrillers, and it was called The Decay of an Angel, and they focused on Ted Bundy. Did you see the show, and what were your thoughts on the program?
Yes. Well, I like that they did the show. I like that they used the real names. I like the scenes of the Washington State Woods, and they picked a guy that looked a lot like Bob Keppel, but when it came to Theodore, cast